Since the dawn of civilization, spies of every nation and culture have worked to infiltrate their adversaries and glean the information that will give their side the advantage. The stakes are sky high, the strategies varied and imaginative, and the ultimate sign of success is that no one ever even knew you were there. In each episode, we will explore the moral and ethical gray zones of espionage, where treachery and betrayal go hand in hand with cunning and courage. This is the Spycraft 101 podcast. Welcome to your clandestine classroom. This is episode number 145 of the Spycraft 101 podcast. Today I'm joined by Bill Mills. Bill holds a BA in history from Framingham State University and has written four nonfiction books about espionage during the First World War. Along the way, he has amassed a significant private collection of original documents, photos, and artifacts related to espionage during that war. I invited Bill onto the podcast today to discuss his newest book, Agent of the Iron Cross, The Race to Capture German Saboteur Assassin Lothar Witzke. It's the story of Germany's highly coordinated and highly effective sabotage campaign against the United States during World War I. Ships, warehouses, and factories across the country were damaged or destroyed by brand new types of destructive devices and a skilled team of saboteurs who evaded capture time and time again until they met their match facing a handful of world-class agents from the U.S. Army's military intelligence section. By the way, if you're looking for a way to get friends and family as interested in history as you are, or if you want to learn something new and unexpected every month, then make sure to check out History by Mail. Every month, History by Mail will send you reproductions of famous and influential historical documents from American history. Accompanying the documents themselves are articles which put them in the context of their times and help you understand the impact they had on the course of American life. The topics are widely varied, so you're always learning something new across themes that include historic inventions, American wars, and foreign diplomatic relations. I'm really enjoying my own subscription because it's opening my eyes to historic events I knew nothing about. For instance, one of the first packages I received contained a reproduction letter from Annie Oakley to President William McKinley, offering her services as a sharpshooter during the Spanish-American War of 1898. Who knew? Not me. You can subscribe for yourself or gift a subscription at historybymail.com for as little as $6.50 a month. Just click the link in the show notes of this episode and use the discount code Justin10 for a permanent 10% off your subscription. Bill, thank you for being here.
Thank you for inviting me, Justin. This is great.
I'm glad to hear it. I've already devoted one episode of the podcast to a portion of this story, as I mentioned to you before. That was episode 88, when we discussed the attack on Black Tom Island in July 1916. But your book covers the entire scope of that period, and it introduced some real-life characters to the story that I was not aware of and that were not a part of that episode at all. So I'm very excited to share even more stories from that period with the listeners.
Great.
So since you focus so much on espionage during World War I, can you tell me what initially drew you to that period?
Well, I think it's a period in espionage history that a lot of people aren't familiar with, and it's allowed me to break new ground on the subject. The books that I've written all are entirely new stories that people aren't familiar with. The second thing is that I think the range of activities that were taking place during World War I in terms of espionage also attracted me to the subject. I mean, when you look at just the United States, there were sabotage operations going on, like, for example, the Black Tom incident. There was economic warfare going on in which governments were trying to buy up commodities to deny them from the enemy. There was biological warfare underway in which teams of agents were actually using biological weapons against horses and cattle to deny them to the enemy. And there was political warfare in which governments were trying to sway the public opinion in different countries, either for or against the war. So it's probably the breadth of activity and also the technology that was actually taking place during World War I has also attracted me. I mean, we think of World War I as a very antiquated period, not in the modern time at all. But the Germans, for example, were using tiny glass tube incendiaries and pencils to sabotage plants and ships. Mm-hmm. There were huge advances in invisible inks. They were using things like mail drops and dead drops and extensive cover identities, things that are very common today, but that were just coming into practice during the period. So I think all these factors are really what has attracted me to the World War I period.
I can understand that completely. And one thing, since I was already slightly familiar, or at least with a portion of this story, I was really excited to see in your book that you had some photos, many photos, in fact, that I had never seen before, including the cigar bombs and the glass tube bombs, which I'm certain we'll get into more later on. But I did not know that photos of those existed, and yet there they are in your book. So I was really glad to see those as well. Can you tell me a little bit about this private collection of documents? Because I noticed so many times, especially in the photo section, that it all says courtesy of the author for the attribution, which is not something I see that often, or at least not to the extent that it appears in your book.
Yeah, that's true. This kind of came as an outgrowth of my interest in espionage history. I read all the popular literature and I collected period books on the subject. And just wanting to gain more knowledge, I started collecting original documents and original photographs from the period. And those photographs, like you said, have never appeared before. I was able to locate them. And as you can imagine, gathering information that was even secret during the time, now it's 100 years on, has not been easy. And it's taken quite a bit of detective work in terms of locating this additional documentation. For example, I obtained letters from the German military attaché Franz von Papen in Switzerland. I obtained information and items related to German naval attaché Karl Boyd in Germany. I was able to locate letters written by the British naval attaché Guy Gaunt in London. And it's taken quite a bit of detective work. For example, I found out that an embassy official, the letters of an embassy official in the British embassy during World War I had come up for sale in Britain. And I was able to contact this person who had bought them and say, oh, by the way, do you have any letters that were written by Guy Gaunt? I'd really like to obtain those. And I was able to get those. So it's very difficult. I mean, at the time, all the German information, for example, in Mexico was destroyed based on an order that went out. I believe it was in January 1919 that they would destroy everything related to the Secret Service. So it's very difficult, but I have been able to locate quite a bit of material, and I do use it in my books and also refer to it while I'm writing my books.
That's terrific. And it, from my perspective anyway, as the reader, it really pays off because just a tremendous depth and level of detail to the story, which I had not expected. I think the first place that I came across this story was a book, I want to say it was called The Secret Army. It was written about the Army Counterintelligence Corps. I think they were called the Corps of Intelligence Police at one point. And it mentions Witski and Yonke that we're going to talk about in a minute. It mentions them just over like a period of maybe three pages of the book. And I honestly thought that their story had been kind of exaggerated a little bit. It was just a little bit too dramatic, you know, the way that it all plays out in the final act. And I read your book and I'm like, no, not only was all of that accurate, but there was so much more to the story that was not covered there either. So just very exciting stuff. And your work has really paid off, in my opinion.
Oh, thank you.
So let's talk about these guys, Witski and Yonke. Can you talk about, I guess the book kind of opens with Witski. So what was he up to at the onset of hostilities?
Well, Lothar Witski was a 19-year-old naval cadet. And the outbreak of the war, he was assigned to active duty on board the German cruiser Dresden. They had a pretty far-ranging cruise across the Pacific. And then the Dresden took part in the Battle of the Falkland Islands, and after which was kind of disastrous for the East Asia Battle Squadron. After that battle, they managed to hide from a British naval squadron in the channels and fjords of Chile. But after a while, the Dresden was sunk offshore in an island called the Isla Mas Atierra. During that engagement, Witski received a serious leg wound, and he was interned at a hospital in Valparaiso. So that's what he was pretty doing at the beginning of the war.
Hmm. Okay. So he's wounded and he's down there and the ship is destroyed. So what happens to the remainder of the crew? Are they all like interned, or are they having to like escape out of that situation? Or, I mean, are the British actively hunting for them? Anything like that?
Well, they were all captured by the British and interned. Witski, again, had a serious leg wound. His kneecap was fractured and he had limited mobility. And he was interned at a hospital in Valparaiso. And probably playing on his leg injury and his inability to walk around, his lack of mobility. He just walked away from the hospital when their guard went down, and he was able to sign on as a seaman aboard a British liner called the Calusa, posing as a Dane. He looked very Danish, and he left on board that ship as a seaman and landed in San Francisco and tried to make his way back to Germany from there.
Okay, I see. I guess he had to go through the German consulate. Was there one on the West Coast at that time?
There were several consulates in the United States. One was in San Francisco, and he went to the embassy seeking assistance to get back to Germany. But by this time, the British naval blockade was in effect, and that denied most German reservists and servicemen the ability to get back to Germany. So the consul at the German embassy in San Francisco offered him the chance to work as a kind of a secret diplomatic courier, carrying messages to other consulates and the German embassy in the United States.
Hmm. Okay. And this was, did he see something in Witzke, or did he just have no one else that he could turn to at that time, you think?
I think he saw something in Witzke. Here's an injured veteran, very patriotic, and saw him as somebody he could, employ, give him an opportunity to work.
Okay. Was this courier work, was it dangerous and exciting, or was he just like a kind of a delivery man, so to speak?
Well, he was kind of a delivery man. And as we'll see, he became kind of bored with it. He wanted to be more than just a letter carrier. And he asked the consul for something a little more exciting to do, something to make a better contribution to the German war effort. And the consul puts him in touch with Kurt Jahnke.
Mm, okay. These two were quite a duo. In the end there. They have a truly amazing story, so I'm glad that we're able to talk about it here. And Jahnke, so Jahnke's already in the United States at this time. Is he already doing work for the German consulate by then?
He is. Kurt Jahnke is actually one of the more amazing characters of World War I espionage, and it's really surprising that more hasn't been written about him. He came to the United States from the province of Posen in Germany as a teenager in the 90s. Very old age, at the age, I think it's 26 or 27, he enlisted in the U.S. Marines in 1909 and remained in the Marines for about a year. And then he joined the Customs Service. And while he was in the Customs Service for a few years, he learned quite a bit about smuggling. And he resided in San Francisco and became very familiar with the city's Chinatown and met many Asian people in Chinatown. And at that time, it was very important for the Chinese in the United States. Many had come here, of course, to work on the railroad and other jobs, that if they died, they wanted to be repatriated to China and be buried in the land of their ancestors. That was very important to them. And Jahnke recognized this as a business opportunity. And he came up with the idea of manufacturing the U.S. government, by the way, wouldn't allow, for sanitary reasons, the Chinese bodies to be shipped back to China. So Jahnke came up with the idea of making these zinc boxes that could be soldered shut and store a casket inside. And he could ship these back to Shanghai and Hong Kong. And for each corpse that he's kind of smuggled back to China, according to the Nazi spy chief Schellenberg, who he worked for in the 1940s, Jahnke made $1,000. And soon after sending enough of dead Chinese bodies back to China, he became a very wealthy man.
Wow. I have to wonder, I would have to look at an inflation calculator, but $1,000 per job in that period of time had to be incredible. That had to be multiple months of salary for most people, I would imagine.
Right. Yeah. He must be very wealthy. Yeah.
Wow. Was this straight smuggling? Was it still illegal, or was the zinc box some sort of legal loophole to allow shipping of remains?
I believe it was smuggling. It's not very clear, and I tried to find detail on it and I couldn't. I think it was smuggling.
Okay. Yeah. They can't really open it up to inspect it. And I guess because he's worked in customs, he would know exactly what he can slip through or not. That is kind of funny that he joins customs and realizes how much money there is to be made by outfoxing customs officials.
Right.
Probably not the only person to do that, but he's a smart guy, clearly, and capable.
Yep.
So at that point, he's just a straight criminal. How does he become involved with German government work in the United States?
Well, he actually worked for the consul BOP at the San Francisco embassy, and he just met him and became familiar with him and became very close to him, as a matter of fact. And he handled many of these special tasks for the embassy. He was involved in trying to disrupt labor, manufacturing munitions. There were a number of different tasks that he worked for, but he started working as a freelance saboteur, the embassy, carrying out sabotage for them is one of the many things that he was doing for the embassy.
This story still is so shocking to me because of how incredibly brazen it is. Like, how could they have anticipated it would be seen as anything other than an act of war? But at the same time, it was very, very prolific, and they were very, very good at it, and they caused a tremendous amount of damage for a long period of time. So I'm still shocked at how aggressively they pursued this sabotage strategy inside the United States. But I guess Yankee was a natural, and a few other guys were naturals as well. So can you talk about the operations, like how Yankee himself kind of performed this work?
Yankee, if I was going to describe Kurt Yankee, I would describe him as incredibly clever and incredibly ruthless. He was very, very smart. And it was a period in American history before we got into World War I where there was very little security. There was very little homeland security. There was a small Bureau of Investigation investigating crimes. You know, I think up until World War I, there were maybe 400 Bureau agents and not a lot of laws that helped them. The Espionage Act of 1917 hadn't become law yet. Mm-hmm. So many of these sabotage attacks were investigated by the police. And when something happened in California or in Washington state, they didn't share notes with the police in New York who were investigating crimes. So there was no organized effort in terms of monitoring things and investigating crime, these sabotage incidents. So I think that helped them. And they were in a very precarious situation. I mean, Minister Bernstorff at the German embassy in Washington was kind of overseeing this, and he knew what was going on. But they had to be very careful that they didn't overstep the bounds, that people didn't find out about these acts. So they were very careful when the sabotage took place and left very little clues.
Were a lot of these chalked up as accidents, at least initially? I mean, these are munitions factories and that sort of thing. I mean, it does happen. Of course, there probably were some legitimate accidents, but were they that good at covering their tracks, or was it more like the forces kind of intended to stop them were just too disorganized at that point?
I think it was a combination of both, but most of them were chalked up as accidents. I mean, they were typically explosives at the plant that they could use, I mean, to cause the explosion, and they would use common household chemicals and things like that to trigger it off. So there wasn't a lot of evidence to be found. And even if you take a look at the biggest of the incidents, the blowing up of the munitions transfer station at Black Tom Island, initially and for years, people thought that was just an accident that took place at the island. Mm-hmm. And the head of the Lehigh Valley Railroad was arrested. A number of the people who owned the storage companies were arrested. The person who owned the barge that blew up was arrested. They thought it was an accident. And it took years, it took decades for them to prove that German agents had actually done it.
Yeah, it was only the post-war compensation kind of stuff. Was it like maybe 1937 or something like that? Is that about right? I'm trying to remember back that far.
That's correct. It was the Mixed Claims Commission, the judges that were set up between the United States and Germany. And it wasn't until 1938 that it was proven that German agents had done that.
Yeah, over 20 years. That's amazing. For what was basically like the largest explosion in this hemisphere up to that point, if I recall correctly.
Yeah, it was an earthquake-level blast. Mm-hmm. That was felt 158 miles away.
My gosh.
And at Black Tom Island, I mean, in many cases, like in the Kingsland plant, they were manufacturing artillery ammunition for the Russians when that blew up. But in the case of Black Tom, that 2.3 million pounds of explosives, it was mostly explosives. There wasn't that much artillery ammunition. It was picric acid and TNT and black powder and smokeless powder, just one big, huge amount of explosives in one area.
My gosh. Yeah, it's hard to imagine. Yeah. So besides that, they had some other very, very significant, very effective attacks. Can you mention a couple of their other attacks that they were able to pull off?
Well, Witzke, I mean, this is a time when a German officer's word was his bond and people really believed in honor. And Witzke claimed in front of a number of agents, I mean, who would be talking to Yankee and other people, that he had participated in a number of incidents. He claimed to have destroyed the boilers of the SS Minnesota in 1915, that he participated with Yankee in the Black Tom munitions depot explosion in 1916, and he claimed to have set off the Mare Island explosion in 1917. And there's three of the biggest incidents.
My gosh. yeah, you did a great job of laying all of these out, and the plot against the SS Minnesota was just incredibly clever to me, because it made it so debatable as to whether sabotage had even occurred, and the way that they covered their tracks so well, and they had a female role player involved to further muddy the waters about who might have been involved. It's really just some incredible stuff there.
Yeah, it is. It's just amazing.
So did they, other than his own statements, was there anything about these attacks that were pointing to these two individuals or pointing toward a German plot at all in concurrently, at that time frame, or was it only years later that they were piecing it all together?
I think it was years later that they were putting it all together. Okay. Not only did Witzke claim that he had taken part in these during the war to other German agents, but after he eventually gets captured, he also gave details to his guards at the place where he was being jailed.
Hmm. Okay, I see. And between the two of them, was this sort of like a master and student kind of relationship, or were they peers essentially by this point?
Early on, it was really, Jahnke really did mentor Witzke, I think, in the art of sabotage. And they were very clever in the way that they did it. I mean, Jahnke became a United States citizen because he knew this would help to deflect suspicion at him. He encouraged Witzke to become a United States citizen also, and Witzke took out first papers towards becoming a naturalized citizen. They worked under aliases. Jahnke's alias was Court Borden, and he would sign on, for example, with the Morse Patrol, where he's paid 25 cents an hour as a guard, as both Court Borden and as Kurt Jahnke. And he even used his alias at his house where he lived in the city directory. Both Court Borden and Kurt Jahnke are listed as living at the same location.
That was an oddity for sure.
Yeah. I mean, so he could tell people if he was Court Borden, oh, I live here. Or if he was Kurt Jahnke, oh, I live here. But when they were planning sabotage, they didn't say, okay, we're going to go blow up this plant on Tuesday night. They were very meticulous in terms of planning it out in detail in advance and planning their alibis in advance before they did something. In the case of Black Tom, for example, Jahnke, or someone who was claiming to be Jahnke, was working for the Morse Patrol during that period when Black Tom blew up. It wasn't Jahnke, it was someone pretending to be Jahnke. Hmm. And Witzke, 5 days before the plant it blew up, I can't remember now if he either registered for the draft or he registered to become a United, or started working towards becoming an American citizen, but 5 days before Black Tom blew up in California, he had done this to deflect attention to him. But in addition to planting alibis, they also planted red herrings after the sabotage took place. They left clues to send people in the wrong direction. And like in the case of the Minnesota, as you say, they had a woman who was known to have frequented the German consulate contact the company that owned the cargo on the boat and tell them that this person named William Martin, who was a water tender on board the boat, had told his wife that he was not going to be coming back and that they were going to be destroying the boat. And the company that owned the cargo notified the shipping company and notified the Bureau of Investigation about this. And after the boat landed, after the Witzke had sabotaged the boilers on board this cargo liner, which was the largest cargo liner in the world, transport ship, it turned out that the British embassy there said, or consulate there said, there was no British Secret Service agent on the West Coast. And this person who has supposed to have told his wife that he was not coming back and that they were going to destroy it, he had no wife when they investigated it. And the Bureau of Investigation, when the ship landed, they figured, okay, we're going to find some clues. We're going to find some evidence. And there was this white substance that had coated all the boiler tubes and destroyed the boilers on this cargo ship. But the results were inconclusive. They couldn't tell whether it was a man-made chemical or if this was something that had happen naturally or not. And in the end, there was nothing left for the Bureau to investigate, and they closed the case. And this was kind of typical of what they would do. Every time there was a major incident, they had alibis all set up and they had clues sending people in the wrong direction.
Before we go on, I want to tell you all about a new podcast from Tenderfoot TV called To Die For. Imagine you were a fly on the wall at a dinner between the Mafia, the CIA, and the KGB. That's where this unprecedented podcast begins. Brought to you by the makers of the hit podcast To Live and Die in L.A., To Die For marks the first time a Russian-trained honey trap has told her story from beginning to end. Taught to seduce men for their secrets, and sometimes their lives, Alia Rosa was trained to believe that her body no longer belonged to her. It belonged to the state. She was meticulously trained to be the perfect weapon, able to seduce her targets into compromising situations that have ended careers, and sometimes lives. From Tenderfoot TV, the studio that brought you Up and Vanished, and To Live and Die in LA. Make sure you check out To Die For, available beginning on March 26th, wherever you get your podcasts. Incredible stuff. Really is incredible. So you mentioned Mare Island, and if I recall correctly, I think like there were six people at Mare Island who were killed by that blast, or was it more than six perhaps?
No, it was six people were killed. There were four of them from a single family, and 31 people were injured as a result of the attack.
Okay. And if I recall correctly, with Black Tom, there was five killed. So these guys were directly responsible for 11 deaths. Pretty much all of them just innocents, just caught up in a blast wave or something like that. Is it possible they were responsible for more deaths as well, along with the tremendous like economic impact and impact to the war effort in Europe?
It may be. I mean, they were involved in, I'm sure, many, many incidents that people never learned about. Mm-hmm. So it is possible. They certainly, as shown in the book, as shown in their own statements, they were not in the least bit concerned with taking human life if they needed to, or if mm-hmm. they thought they needed to.
So at some point after all of this, I know Yankee had to move down to Mexico City for quite some time. So what was it that spurred him to do that?
Well, when the United States got in the war, the consulates and the German consulates and the German embassy in the United States were closed. And this was the way that they were communicating with their spy masters in Europe and also being funded for their activities. So they needed to create a new way of both reaching to the intelligence authorities in Europe and getting funded. So they went to Mexico City, and the Minister Eckhart there was in ready contact with Europe and received the funds and everything to fund their operations. So when they left the country as a result of the United States getting in the war, it wasn't so much that they were afraid of getting caught. It was that they needed to keep the channels of communication open with Europe. And even after we got in the war, they would freely go back and forth over the U.S. border to conduct operations mm-hmm. and then return to their haven in Mexico City.
I see. Were they performing any operations inside of Mexico, or was it like a staging area more for going back north to the United States for more sabotage?
Well, the Germans and the Mexican government were very close during World War One. I think there were 50 German officers serving as officers in the Mexican army. Oh, wow. They were also providing them with money and, when possible, with some weapons. And so they had very close relations with Germany. And the Mexicans would support, to an extent, German operations and German covert operations into the United States. Hmm. But it was really a balancing act. 2 years before 1918, of course, there was the Pancho Villa raid against Columbus, New Mexico. Pancho Villa and 400 or 500 of men, his men, crossed 3 miles over the border and attacked Columbus, New Mexico. And as a result of that, in 1916, the United States sent a punitive expedition into Mexico of 6,600 men that eventually grew to 10,000. And we also moved the entire National Guard to the Mexican border, possibly to even have a bigger invasion of Mexico. So the Mexican government was kind of, again, on a tightrope. They wanted to remain friendly and have good relations with the Germans, but they didn't want the Germans doing something so big, so major, that it would cause the United States to go back into Mexico.
Yeah, when you officially title something a punitive expedition into another country, they probably knew that we were not messing around, and we clearly had the forces available to do something. So I can certainly understand their reticence. So why did they have such a positive relationship with Germany that they would take these risks? I mean, was there some benefit, or was it just like a longstanding close political relationship?
In 1917, 1918, President Carranza had just taken the presidency, just been elected president of Mexico, and they had just gone through a very long revolution. So the country wasn't entirely stable. He wasn't really on solid ground in terms of his presidency. And they were looking to Mexico primarily for financial and economic assistance. And for that reason, they were very close to them. Hmm. And also, they saw them, I think, as an ally against the United States, which was this, you know, colossus to the north mm-hmm. that they kind of feared at the time.
Okay. Yeah, I see. They can kind of use those German saboteurs as a lever in a certain way, I suppose. So at what point does the U.S. government finally kind of start to seriously pursue these saboteurs? Like, was there a particular tip-off or something like that? Like, how did they finally, you know, start to zero in on Yankee and Witski?
Well, in terms of sabotage in general, after the United States got into the war in April 1917, it really went on a war footing. And the Bureau of Investigation was expanded. The military intelligence section of the Army formed the Corps of Intelligence Police, over 1,000 civilian employees, many of them largely police officials, searching for sabotage. At the same time, there were large groups formed in the United States, private groups, such as the American Protective League, which was 250,000 volunteer businessmen in the United States working as kind of amateur detectives for the U.S. Justice Department. And part of their job was maintaining vigilance against German sabotage activity. Then you had other groups like the National Councils of Defense, the American Defense Society, volunteer organizations, all working kind of undercover, covertly, keeping an eye on what was going on in the United States. And for example, in terms of the American Protective League, which grew to 250,000 members secretly working in the United States, they were established in every company and plant in the United States, every industry watching for sabotage. So when this occurred, espionage and sabotage within the United States dropped off dramatically. And when you look at some of the agents that came in late, like in the 1917 period, such as Madame de Victorica, they were kind of hiding out. They were trying to figure a way almost to get back to Germany because they just didn't have the ability to conduct sabotage.
Oh, wow. So everything changed very quickly. And since you mentioned the American Protective League, I saw that you've written a book called The League about them. And honestly, I have to go pick up that one now because the little bit that you talk about them, the few pages devoted to them in this book, really kind of whet my appetite, honestly, because that was another thing that I was not aware of. And I'm not sure how I somehow missed, you know, 250,000 guys mobilizing to protect against sabotage, but it had, you know, passed me by somehow. So now I've got to dig into that more in your other book.
Sure. It's a fascinating story. I mean, in a sense, a secret police was established in the United States during World War I. And originally, it was because they were afraid of the large number of German Americans in this country, Austrian Americans. They were afraid that this large group would be conducting wide-scale activities, sabotage and things like that after we got into the war. Mm-hmm. There were 8 million German Americans in the United States when the United States went to war, and there were 500,000 German reservists in the United States. So that's largely why the American Protective League was formed. But as the laws in the United States became more draconian during World War I, and there were laws, I mean, the Espionage Act, the original Espionage Act and the Sedition Act of 1917 and 1918, by March of 1918, it was actually illegal in the United States to say anything against the government, anything against the army, anything against the war, anything against the flag. And if you did, you could be sent to jail for as long as 10 years and a $10,000 fine. And there were people who did go to jail against this. So although the American Protective League was founded to protect the country, by 1918, it had become almost a secret police within the United States.
My gosh. Yeah, the pendulum swung very far the other direction.
Yeah.
Once the war started. I see. Dang, some wild stuff. So how did Army intelligence end up being kind of the lead in this pursuit of the guys, not the fledgling Bureau of Intelligence, for example?
It's kind of interesting that most people don't know this, but in addition to what today is the FBI, was the Bureau of Investigation in 1918, but U.S. Army military intelligence was operating in the United States and doing domestic intelligence in the United States during World War I. And because Mexico, with what had occurred with Pancho Villa's attack, for example, against Columbus and other things, it was seen as a major area of security that they had to monitor. And so operations were run into Mexico, and a person who worked for military intelligence named Byron Butcher was in charge of running a lot of the covert operations that occurred into Mexico. And the military intelligence, in the end, will infiltrate, penetrate the German espionage establishment in Mexico. And that will be eventually the undoing of Witski and the mission that Yankee sends him on in 1918.
Yeah, Butcher is just an incredibly impressive character. I mean, he was really, really the right man in the right place at the right time, it seems. But was he like an army officer or an army NCO, or was he just like someone that they recruited for this type of work, like clandestine kind of work?
No, he is somebody who they recruited. He was recruited into Army Military Intelligence in 1916 as a civilian employee. His title was Special Agent with Military Intelligence. He had been a journalist starting in 1912 in Mexico. And throughout the period of the Mexican Revolution, he had written stories for a newspaper in Arizona on the Mexican Revolution. And he became very close with a person named, a general named Alvaro Obregón, who would become one of the most significant figures in the revolution and also would be elected twice as president of Mexico. And so the military intelligence in the Southwest Bureau of the military intelligence spotted him as someone who is very capable, somebody who had lived in Mexico, was familiar with Mexico, spoke Spanish fluently, and at the same time knew a number of the political leaders in Mexico and saw him to be a real asset. And that's why he was hired into military intelligence.
Okay. And during this time, he continued writing articles as a journalist, right? Was that just a part of his cover, or was that a part of the operation as well?
That was kind of part of the ways that they were fighting the German espionage. They would find things out about what the Germans were up to, and then he would write articles. And these articles received international distribution. And they would use these articles to tell the truth, but paint a negative picture of Mexico, and also use them to disrupt intelligence activities that the Germans were doing in Mexico. For example, there was a person named Ricardo Schwirtz, who was a German agent. He was a major in the German army. He was briefly captured in Arizona and escaped back into Mexico. And while Butcher was writing stories on this, in his stories, he made it sound like Schwirtz had told the Americans everything he knew as part of a scheme to make things difficult for Schwirtz when he returned to Mexico.
Oh, wow. Yeah. My gosh. I'm having a little bit of a hard time wrapping my head around that, in the sense that he is a special agent, like you said, and he's investigating the sabotage ring. And instead of it being some sort of like, you know, top secret investigation of some sort, he's just basically publishing his findings in the newspaper pretty much right after he finds them out. Is that correct? Or am I kind of misjudging how this occurred?
No, that's correct. He was throughout the period that he was working for military intelligence from 1916 to 1918, he was continuing to publish stories to disrupt German espionage activity.
Oh, man. Clever. Two birds with one stone there. So it's like an information operation, influence operation, as well as an investigation. Did they have any inkling, the you know, Yankee and everyone else involved, that Byron Butcher was coming for them? Or was he just like a pesky reporter as far as they were concerned?
No, Yankee knew who Butcher was. And among the other things that Yankee did in Mexico City, he eventually becomes in charge of all espionage activity on the American continent. He is named as chief confidential agent by German naval intelligence in 1918. One of the things he did in Mexico City, he had a clipping service that looked through newspapers and magazines, primarily in the United States, for articles that were important to the war and that were related to intelligence and things that the German military could make use of. And those articles were sent back to Germany. In the course of doing this, he became very familiar with who Byron Butcher was based on his byline. And as described in the book, Yankee becomes convinced that Butcher was responsible for the Zimmerman telegram. They believed he stole the Zimmerman telegram in Mexico City. And for that reason, he was marked for death by Yankee.
Oh, wow. So they were actively hunting Butcher at one point.
That's correct.
They clearly didn't get him, but I guess I shouldn't spoil that anyway. They didn't get him, but how was he able to avoid that? Was he just too hard of a target on the other side of the border, or was he just too wily and slipped away?
Well, in terms of this operation, by January of 1918, as a side note, I mean, Germany had been to war for 3.5 years. And the German public was war-weary. They were starving due to the naval blockade. The country was on the verge of social collapse. And so what the Germans wanted to do at that time was to create an incident in the United States, because the Americans were about to ship millions over the course of 1917, and especially in 1918, millions of men over into Europe. They wanted to come up with a way of distracting the United States military, just as the raid by Pancho Villa had done, away from Europe and to keep American troops at home. So they were planning to, they called it, there would be an invasion of the United States from Mexico. Really, I think they were planning to create an incident, some sort of an attack against the United States. And they formed a number of training camps in Mexico, where they were training reservists of the German army and Mexican conscripts for this small force that would go across and, quote, invade the United States, but really create this attack that would distract things. And before this took place, Yankee's plan was to send Witski to the United States to launch a terror campaign and try to create chaos and disorder in the United States that would help with this, you know, kind of fake invasion that was going to take place, and again, create more attention on the Southwest to divert American troops. Now, part of the mission that Yankee sends Witski on, in addition to things like blowing up plants and trying to foment an insurrection in the United States, one of his assignments will be to kill Byron Butcher, which he's unsuccessful at doing.
Oh, man. It's dramatic stuff. Yeah. So ultimately, Butcher and some of his, you know, companions in the army are able to put a stop to all this. How does that happen exactly? Like, how do they get their hands on their men, on Witski and Yankee?
They were never able to catch Yankee. Yankee, I think it was about six months after the end of the war, slipped back to Germany, and he was never captured. Witski, as described in the book, Army Military Intelligence, has penetrated the German espionage establishment in Mexico City, and they have agents of their own that are watching and providing information. And by the time that Witski is sent to the United States, he's under around-the-clock surveillance, and he is captured by them.
Okay, so he comes back across the border, and he is like, they're watching him the whole time. I guess they were expecting him. They knew where he would arrive and when and that sort of thing?
Yeah. They were informing him from the time that he left Mexico City until he reached Nogales, Sonora, and then crossed from Nogales, Sonora into Nogales, Arizona. By the time he reaches Nogales, Sonora, he's literally being watched around the clock.
Oh, man. Yeah, those guys were so good, and they covered their tracks successfully for so long, and then ultimately it seemed like they ran across guys who were just a little bit better than them. It was kind of how I felt as I read through all of that and did not realize just who they had come up against, but ultimately for the American side, at least, it worked out really well.
That's right.
So they arrested him. What was Butcher? I mean, did he actually like put the cuffs on him, so to speak?
He actually did. He literally, based on the testimony of people at the time, literally put the handcuffs on Witski, who had come to kill him.
Man, that's got to be a good feeling after all of that. He's tried in the United States. Is he tried as under some sort of espionage statute or as a foreign combatant or what exactly?
Well, he was tried under a law. It has to do with the code of justice of the army at the time. And spying at that time, the statute that he was claimed to have violated was that he had been at an army encampment seeking information and been captured. Now, in actuality, he hadn't been doing that. He was in Nogales, Arizona, going to put money in a bank account. And the nearest American encampment was a mile away. Mm-hmm. But that was what he was tried under. And he was obviously a dangerous agent, and definitely a spy in America on a mission of, you know, death and destruction. But what he was charged with doing, he actually hadn't been doing. They kind of used the law to convict him. And I think that's part of what played into the fact that his sentence was commuted in 1920 by President Wilson. I think that was one of the factors that played into it. At the end of his court-martial trial, he's sentenced to death. He was sentenced to be hung. And there was a review of his trial record, and eventually the sentence is commuted. He was very fortunate. I mean, I think it had to do with the sequence and the time that passed between the time when he was captured, the time that he was tried, the war ended, and it was, you know, I think, almost several years after the war, that his sentence hadn't been carried out and was commuted. And I think that played into the fact that he was able to stay alive. And eventually he will be pardoned by Coolidge and sent back to Germany. Mm-hmm. I mean, if you contrast that with, for example, the 8 German saboteurs in 1942 who were captured, who had landed by submarine and were captured by the FBI, 6 of those 8 were sent to the electric chair in 1942.
Yeah.
And yet Witzke was basically set free.
Mm-hmm. Those guys, if I recall, I know it's kind of a tangent, but within like 30 days of their sentencing or something like that, wasn't the sentence carried out? It was fast.
I think they were captured in June, and I think they were executed in August of 1942.
So yeah, Witzke was comparatively very lucky to make it 24 months or whatever it was and then be pardoned. So right. Was there some sort of specific overture from the German government about Witzke because he was like, you know, one of their best guys and did the most damage here? Or was it just sort of a general condition of the armistice and the peace accords?
Well, after he'd been captured and the war ended, the German government hadn't forgotten about Witzke. And they put significant pressure on the United States in calling Witzke, you know, the last prisoner of war. They pointed out that the French had released all their German prisoners of war. The English had released all their prisoners of war. And here they pointed to Witzke as a prisoner of war who was still being held by the Americans. Mm. And there was really strong pressure placed on the army and on the U.S. government to release Witzke. And that's eventually what happened.
Okay, I see. Yeah, so he very, very lucky, all things considered, certainly. Yeah. Did he continue to serve the German government after this?
He did. He originally went back to Germany. He served in what was called the Black Reichswehr, which was a secret expanded German army that was sort of an underground army. He actually went back to work for a short period for Kurt Jahnke, who had established a private intelligence organization in Europe. But over the years, into the 1930s, he's believed to have been working for the German Abwehr. And when World War II begins, he is actually in France working at sending German secret agents across to invade to England for espionage and sabotage.
Wow. Wow. That's amazing. So this entire arc here in North America was just like a part of his story then.
That's true.
Incredible. And the same goes for Jahnke then. Jahnke had a long career as well, is what I'm hearing.
He did. He returns to Germany. He actually, at one point, became a politician. He was elected to the parliament in Prussia, the Prussian Diet. And for 2 years, he was a politician writing laws. And then he founded an intelligence organization for the late Weimar Republic and then for the Nazi Party in the early 1940s. Eventually, he will work for what was called the SD, the security service of the SS under Reichsfuhrer Heinrich Himmler. And using his network of contacts around the world, both political and government bureaucrats, he will carry out a number of top secret missions for the German government during World War II. When the war ends, he's kind of out of power at that point. His star really has fallen. And he was captured by the Russians. And Jahnke is believed to have been executed by the Russians in Moscow in 1950.
Oh, wow. Wow, wow, wow. Yeah, that's the worst possible ending is of World War II is for a German to be captured by the Russians, from what I understand. So you say believed, so I guess like the documentation just kind of disappears at some point on him and he's never heard from again, essentially?
Well, he had disappeared in 1945, and British and American intelligence was looking for him and wanted to find out more about him because they knew that he had this extensive network around the world that now could be employed by the Russians if he was working with the Russians. And at one point in the 1920s, he was not only acting as a spy for the Germans, he was acting as a spy for the Russians, for the Soviets as well.
Really?
So for years, they questioned people. They questioned his boss during World War II, Schellenberg, and they were unable to find out any information. They just knew that he had disappeared in Pomerania. And it's actually relatively recently, since the wall fell, that information has come out, documentation that states that he was executed in Moscow in 1950.
Okay, I see. Yeah, that was, I mean, Stalin was still in control, and I guess he was purging people left and right. And I can see how, you know, Jahnke would have been of suspect loyalties, even under the best of circumstances, probably.
Right. Even Walter Nikolai, who was in charge of military intelligence for the Germans during World War I, he hadn't really done that much during World War II, but he was also another one taken back to Moscow.
Oh, really? Wow. Yeah. Amazing. Boy, those guys certainly lived full and interesting, exciting lives in a way.
True. Yeah.
Wow. And so what about Butcher? Did he continue with Army intelligence after all this?
No, Butcher, actually, he will leave military intelligence in 1918. And his leaders in military intelligence, his boss, are concerned that, as I mentioned, Butcher was very close with Mexican political officials. And this is still at a time when the United States still has concerns about Mexico as a potential enemy in some way. So they're kind of concerned that he's very close with Mexican leadership. So they will transfer him away from the Mexican border where he wants to live and stay in contact with his friends in Mexico. And for this reason, he leaves military intelligence in 1918. And he becomes a businessman. And over the years, due to the Depression and things like that, he'll fall on hard times, I think, by the late 1940s. But during the war, he worked for a shipyard in Texas. And while Witski is dispatching secret agents to attack England and Yankees performing secret operations for Heinrich Himmler, Byron Butcher is working on military warships for the Navy in Texas.
Oh, wow. Yeah, so he still had something to contribute to the effort, like a generation later, practically.
Right.
Man. Wow, what a story. These guys, I mean, they really are some special individuals, and I think that you've told their story in greater depth than just about anybody has at this point.
Oh, thank you.
Yeah, Bill, I really enjoyed the book, and I appreciate you talking to me about it today. And for the listeners out there, if you want to pick it up, the book by Bill Mills is Agent of the Iron Cross, The Race to Capture German Saboteur Assassin Lothar Witski. It's out and it's available right now. And there is a lot more of the book that we have not covered during this interview. We haven't gotten at all into some of the code breaking that occurred back then. And Bill tells that part of the story in a way that I've never seen before, because he actually breaks down the code with a lot of illustrations throughout the book so that you can sort of follow along and understand exactly how it was diagrammed and mapped out and then broken down piece by piece, which was very, very, very educational for me. And we also haven't talked about my favorite character from the book entirely, out of a book full of incredible characters, who, Bill, correct me if I'm wrong, he just went by the digraph like A1, right? Like Source A1 was how he was mostly known.
That was his code name given to him by military intelligence, yeah.
A1. Yeah, well, that's a great one for him, because he was an A1 source for certain. So Bill wrote extensively about him, and we haven't had time to talk about him today, but you are in for quite a treat once you pick up the book. I can promise you that. So Bill, thank you so much for your time. I really appreciate it. And like I said, I'm looking forward to reading The League as well.
Thank you, Justin. It's been great taking part in the conversation.
Great. So are you working on another book right now? Have you got number 5 in the queue at the moment?
Well, at the moment, I'm actually researching several ideas. It's actually the hardest part is coming up with the topic and locating enough information to tell it in detail. I find that actually more difficult than writing the book. So at the moment, I'm researching several ideas about espionage during World War I or World War II.
Oh, wow. Fantastic. Yeah, you've set kind of a high benchmark, honestly, as far as I've seen, so I can understand why you would want to be able to tell the story the best way that you possibly can before you really commit to it. That's very understandable. Well, thanks again, Bill, and I look forward to whatever you write after this. And like I said, I'll be picking up The League very soon. Thank you for your time.
Thank you, Justin.
Take care.
You too. Thank you.
If you're interested in more of Spycraft 101, look for my page on Instagram at Spycraft101. You can also find more great articles on my website, spycraft101.com. Thank you all for listening, and I hope you'll stick around, because there is lots more to come.
Disclaimer. This podcast is for entertainment purposes only. The stories and statements expressed herein are experiences and opinions. They may not reflect the views of the host or the production studio. It's okay if you disagree with our content. No piece of media is right for everyone. If you love Spycraft 101, please check us out online, on Instagram, on YouTube, and especially on Patreon. Thank you for listening.